Literacy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. I'm happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper Mary Glickman. She was here not too long ago to talk about a wonderful book that she wrote called By the Rivers of Babylon. And now I have her back because I wanted to talk about this book. It's called An Undisturbed Peace. And it is so amazing. And the research that went into it, I just have to find out how she did it. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Kathy.
Well, we got through the hurricane. What do you think I was doing during the hurricane? Reading, of course. As long as we had electricity, I thought, I'm going to read everything. And one of the books that I picked up, because I've been thinking a lot about By the Rivers of Babylon, I picked up your book, An Undisturbed Peace, and reread it, parts of it. I didn't have to reread it all. But it is such an important book, and it is about a time that most people don't know about, pre-Civil War. And the research that you went through to get this book must have been enormous. So let's start from the beginning. I'm always interested in where somebody gets an idea for a book, how it just sort of does it pop into your head. So let's start with the idea, and let's work through and tell us your characters are amazing. So what was a germ? I mean, what was a moment when the idea for a book set in the 1830s?
I wish I had something dramatic to tell you, but the truth was that my agent, the brilliant Peter Riva, after I'd written three novels about race relations in the South throughout the 20th century, and I was saying, well, what shall I cover now? He said to me, Mary, I think you would be perfect to write about the Indian Removal Act. And I thought, oh, well, that is an interesting topic. So I started researching it, and I came to really be involved, wrapped up in the subject very quick. As far as my research goes, I did various kinds. I went to Cherokee, North Carolina, where a remnant of Cherokee have lived since the removal, and in fact they are known as the Eastern Cherokee Tribe. I visited their community, I visited their museum, I watched their play that they have on the Trail of Tears, which is excellent, outdoors in the mountains, it's beautiful. And while I was there, I found my primary research text, and that is the Payne Buttrick Papers, which is a contemporaneous account of Cherokee life during the period. In fact, one of the, Reverend Buttrick was the author, Mr. Payne was the editor. He went along on the Trail of Tears with the Cherokee. So it's a fascinating, you know, bird's eye view. You're able to get all of the cultural details one could wish for in that those works. So I found myself quite lucky to be there to find these excerpts.
Well, of course, you are right there, right in the area. So you're literally walking in the footsteps of Cherokees. I think that is inspiring in and of itself, knowing that you are there and the people who were there before you. The idea for the book, the idea of doing this, the Relocation Act, explain what this was, because this is...
What the Relocation Act was? Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, let's see. Around the time of the American Revolution, the Cherokee tribe had owned probably 80% of Georgia and North Carolina, so, you know, most of the states. They were the North Carolina, South Carolina, Alabama, West Virginia, Virginia. They controlled about 80% of the landmass. But when, as time went by, and Americans kept wanting to settle in what they thought of as virgin land, it was really belonged to somebody else, the Cherokee landmass shrunk to about 20% of what it had been. And then gold was discovered in Georgia, which meant that, of course, now the United States wanted to swallow up Georgia. And Georgia and North Carolina were where most of the remnant of the Cherokee still lived, about 16,000 people. Now, eventually, Andrew Jackson decided, as president, he was a very almost dictatorial type. He decided that he would remove all of the Cherokees from the area and send them off to Oklahoma, and let them form a new land there that the United States was going to own Georgia and North Carolina. And thus, this forced march of the Cherokee is known as the Trail of Tears. Approximately 6,000 people died during it of starvation and disease.
When you think about it, the Cherokee, who were in an area that's lush and green and farming was easy because, I mean, everything will grow in those areas. Just to imagine them arriving in Oklahoma, I mean, I can't imagine myself arriving in Oklahoma. And it breaks your heart. And of course, you managed to capture this, the beauty of their life and the way they lived, their beliefs. So as you're doing the research and obviously falling in love with the whole tribe.
The Payne Buttrick papers, as I say, they were instrumental because I think that there are a few other texts, but I think there are, there's a lot of sort of New Age fantasy about Native Americans that has nothing to do with the way Native Americans lived then or now, you know?
Yeah.
And it's difficult to find the accurate stuff, which is why I was so happy with these six volumes. And in there, you realize that the Cherokee were really remarkable, especially in terms of women's rights. Women were in control of finances. They were heiresses. They owned all the property. They were sexually, they could do whatever they wanted. They could take up with someone or not. They could get divorced easily. The children belonged to them, not the father. And in which case, often the uncle of the of a child might be closer to that child than their father. It was a remarkable culture. And unfortunately, with the land grab that Jackson was attempting to make, and indeed made, they got the idea, the Cherokee, that if they adopted colonial ways, the ways of the white people around them, that they would be accepted as equals and as Americans and not have to leave their land. So they actually, position of the woman declined into, you know, the common female roles of the day in the white community, and they developed plantations and hired slaves. They bought slaves, African-American slaves, and they became like white plantation owners, thinking this was going to protect them. But of course, in the end, it did not.
So you have three main characters. The way that you have brought them together, three diverse characters, each bringing a different view to what's happening. When you decided on a Cherokee, you selected a woman because, as you said, the women were strong. So tell us about, in the book, of course,
Marion.
She has an anglicized name. Was she the first character that came to mind? How did you develop?
Actually, I think Abe, the Jewish peddler, immigrant, was my first one because his family name is a family name I've used in all of my novels. And, you know, this was the early Sassaportas that came, you know, I have them in the 50s and the 60s, 1950s, 60s as well, but this is the origin family. So he came first, and then I thought, well, he'll fall in love with a Cherokee woman who really isn't as interested as he would like in him. And then I thought of Jacob, the slave that is her true love, and it just kind of fell in place after that.
It was very unusual when you came out with the character of Marianne that she was actually a woman who went to England.
Oh, yeah. Well, this quote, civilization of the Cherokee, which is what the white community called it. They called them the civilized tribe because they lived like white men. Part of what they did was they would send their children to school in London. They would send them to school in Boston. They would send them, you know, to Tony schools all over the Northeast, and then they would come back properly anglicized. It was very different from the forced education of Native American children later in American history, when the churches picked them up and took them off and cut their hair. I mean, you know, it was different, but yet the effect was the same.
I think it must have been the idea of taking a Cherokee woman and bringing her to London. All of the research that went around this must have been fun for you.
Oh, it was. I learned so much, you know, and that's part of what writing an historical piece is about, is what you learn. You know, there's always something that you're learning. Doesn't mean that you use all of the things you're learning, but, you know, the ones you do that particularly enchant you are useful, that, you know, there's never a boring moment. You're never, you know, if you are an author who's working on a, you know, a quote, straight modern novel, there'll be times when you don't know what to do. You don't know, well, what direction shall I go in this? And you sweat over it, and, you know, perhaps you have a little block. That doesn't happen when you write historical novels because, okay, I don't know where it's going next. I might as well read some more research. And then suddenly the idea appears before you. It's like, for example, if you'll recall in the book, there's the rubber craze of 1830, in which rubber was first galvanized and made available for products, and the entire country went crazy for rubber. I had no idea about what that was all about or how I was going to use it, but I found a good use for it, I think. But that was just a very serendipitous kind of discovery. While I was looking up something else, I fell upon it, you know, and that's also very helpful. Good luck is important.
It is, and sometimes just the right footnote will take you on a path that's so exciting.
Oh, yeah.
One little sentence will say, whoa, did that happen? And then you start following that footnote, and it in itself is like an entire world.
It's a nice journey.
When I moved to England, of course, I'm talking book. Even then, I'm asking people their favorite authors. One of the things that completely surprised me was that English people knew James Fenimore Cooper. They know his books. Their idea of America is so much formed by his writing. The way that you write about the land, about the environment, about everything, it does remind one of James Fenimore Cooper's writing.
Oh, I like that one. Well, you know, what's interesting about when you speak of American authors of the era, of the early 19th century, who were very popular in London, oddly enough, the editor of the Payne-Buttrick papers, he got involved with the Cherokee because he had been an actor and a writer and had lived in London for a long time, and he wanted to develop a journal that was purely American for the European market because they were so interested. And so he discovered Reverend Buttrick along the way of trying to do that. But he also, number one, he wrote the song Home Sweet Home, and he also, while he lived in London, he was a rival for the affections of Mary Shelley with none other than Washington Irving.
Wow. isn't it wonderful, the things you discover, isn't it?
Yes.
All of these links, all of these golden threads. So
that's right.
It is, and your writing, it's evocative. It captures everything, this sound, the smells, the flavor of the South and of that period. Let's talk a little bit about the slave. Let's talk about how he comes into the story, Jacob.
Well, Jacob had a sad beginning. I mean, his mother was the slave of a farmer, and it was just, I think, the three of them living together. And he was a little boy, the son of the slave master. So one day, he and his mother are walking to go deliver some fruit to somebody or something, and they are beset upon by a Cherokee tribe who kidnapped them, which was common enough behavior at the time. But he was given to a woman who had a Cherokee woman who had no children, and she raised him as if he were her son. He becomes very, very conversant in Cherokee ways and skills. And but when it comes time, when she dies, he realizes he's still a slave. He's the property of the tribe now, and he's given away to another person. And the other person happens to be Marion, the Indian princess. And she is a princess, the Native American princess. her father, who owns a white man's plantation. He's a Cherokee with a white man's plantation. So he's sold into that family, and that brings him close to Marion, and they fall madly in love. Then what are you going to do?
Well, now, well, in your hands, it's going to be a fascinating story, that's for sure.
Okay. Well, I enjoyed writing it, I have to say. I did.
Well, I think that comes through. And as I said, it is so wonderful when you find a book that is about a period of time that you don't know about, and then suddenly it opens your eyes to so many things. Of course, you combine here the three biggest ideas here of Jews who suffer and have been sent into slavery, the Cherokees, Native Americans, indigenous people sent into slavery, and then, of course, African Americans, blacks from Africa who are sent into slavery. So you bring all three together in such a way that's so informative and so compelling. When people read this, all of these ideas, there's so much to ponder, there's so much to think about. The way that you write, it's cohesive, and it's really a fascinating story.
Well, I can tell you, I appreciate your saying that very much. I have to agree with you. and also, I have to say that you can be assured that it was meticulously researched. And you know, that down to the details of clothing and food and you know, all of that. Because that's what grounds, it's the common daily things, I think, that ground a historical novel in its period. The big events, you know, people have a general idea of the big events and they expect they're coming. But it's the detail, the homely detail, you might say, that I think really anchors the story.
That's true. That's why I mentioned earlier, the sounds and the smells, you bring it all in. Well, you do that with all your writing. You know, your book, By the Rivers of Babylon, there we have a pit master who's the main character. And I tell you, when you read that book, you want to go out, you want barbecue. You know, so the way that you bring the food
in. I think book club should get Babylon and have barbecue book club parties.
I agree. I think it's absolutely perfect, because when you read that book, you really do want barbecue and you want the sound of banjos. And in this case, as I said, you bring in the sounds, the flavor, I love the descriptions of what people are wearing, everything. It all works so well. And it is, I think, a brilliant book, a wonderful, wonderful historical document now for people because of your thorough research.
Kathy, just one last thing. You must know that I have noticed over the years that this has been in publication, which is about 6 or 7 years, I think that every fall there's a little bump in my sales. Might not be huge, but it's a bump in my sales. I think schools are reading it.
Well, I hope so, because they will learn a lot. It's a book that you will read once. And as I said, during the hurricane, I was picking up different books, just going through the ones, you know, that I thought I'd... And this book, when I picked it up again, I thought, wow, I just have to find out how you did it. I think you're fantastic, Mary. You're a wonderful writer. And the name of the book is An Undisturbed Peace. It's a novel by Mary Glickman. It's brilliant, people. You have to get it. And Mary, your website is just Mary Glickman, right?
MaryGlickman.com.
And the name of the book, An Undisturbed Peace. You can get it online. And again, Mary, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
It's always a joy to talk to you. Okay. You take care now. Okay. Bye-bye now.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
Listen.com.
I'm Steve Kathan. New evidence for authorities in eastern Pennsylvania as they hunt for a convicted killer who escaped from prison last week. State police.